From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the November edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we take you to the Mythbusters event, where former Codebreaker and GCHQ director Sir Arthur Bonsall made a rare public appearance. He set the record straight about the Battle of Britain and the eccentricities of some of the Codebreakers, among other matters. We'll also get the lowdown on this year's Enigma Challenge, where today's bomb team deduced the Enigma settings much more quickly than the average achieved by the Codebreakers at wartime Bletchley Park, and beat their own record from last year. And the fascinating story of Wynne Ribchester, who lived at Bletchley Park as a child and was the youngest person ever to sign the Official Secrets Act. But first, an insight into the mystery of the pigeon, which appears to have fallen down a chimney in 1944, its coded message never reaching its destination. David Martin from Bletchingley in Surrey found the bird skeleton when he cleared out the chimney to put in a new fireplace. It was intact and complete with a red canister containing a coded message. Colin Hill, who curates the Pigeons at War exhibition at Bletchley Park, says in several decades as a pigeon historian, he's never come across an enciphered message carried by a bird. So, Colin, how did the message first come to your attention?
A gentleman in the park itself came up to me one Sunday morning and asked me if I would be interested in this message, and he showed me it. And I said, well, can I have the bloke's name and telephone number? No, he said he won't talk to nobody, but I'll get him to phone you. The bloke phoned, and the story's just carried on from there. He seems quite a nice bloke, but he won't let us have any of it at the moment. Took all its time to get him to send it to GHQ at Cheltenham.
Because he thought he'd never see it again, and he thought, you know, didn't want to part with it.
Yeah, he gave him a month to break a code and wants it back.
So when you first became aware of the message, did you think, this can't be right?
When I first came across the message, I thought, yeah, it can't be the right message, because it was like no other one we've ever came across. We've got around 100, 150 of them. All the messages that I've read and the RPRA have read are all been in longhand.
Have you never even seen anything enciphered in any way?
All of them are in plain text. None of them have ever been coded or secret service, as we call it. But I think it is something to do with Bletchley Park, seriously. It's just one of those messages that you only see now and then. And the thing that's always made me interested, we can't find the two pigeons on any records anywhere. And that means it's got to have been Bletchley Park, because this was the only other place that had pigeons here for secret messages.
Where they wouldn't have been recorded.
Yeah, nothing was recorded about our pigeons being at Bletchley Park. The gentleman who looked after them, he never even wrote down when he paired them up, how many eggs they laid or anything.
Do you think he kept all that information in his head, or do you think he perhaps had, you know, hidden coded notebooks that he destroyed? Or
he seemed the sort of pigeon man that would keep most of it in his head. He never even told his two children anything about what he was doing up here. He took his daughter once to Sandringham to pick up some pigeons, and that made us think that the pigeons might have come from the Royal Lofts. But we've checked that all out. He went and picked up four pigeons for himself. Nothing to do with the pigeons here.
Well, like so many people that worked here, got to the end of their lives without ever telling their families what they'd done and how important it was.
Yeah, that's very true. John Chapman, he always told the same story outside the post office about this lady who lived very close to the park, 80 plus, and had never told a soul. And I'd heard it so many times. And this particular day, I asked him if it were true. And John said, I don't lie. We went then for a walk up to where this old lady lived. And to my surprise, it was my eldest sister. Never knew that she ever was up here. She never told my parents right until she died. Nobody knew. She just laughed it off when I asked her. because she knew I was up here then with the pigeons and everything.
So that's in the last 20 years?
She died 3 years ago. It was, yeah, in the last 6 years.
And she wouldn't tell you?
Never mentioned it. And I've had a chat to my nieces, her daughters. They knew nothing.
You see, a lot of people carried it right to their graves, didn't they? Because that was the vow they made.
Yeah, and how John Chapman found out anything from her, I don't know.
So this is quite an unusual situation, isn't it, that it had an encoded message? So it tells you that they were being used in even more risky situations than perhaps we knew about.
Yeah, it convinced us that a lot of these pigeons, when we just say, oh, they were dropped behind enemy lines, that was it. But when you see a message like this, you know that they must have been dropped into very difficult situations, or the people that looked after them must have been. It can't be a one-off. There's got to have been other messages just the same as this.
And we may never find out, but if we do find out what the message said, I wonder what the consequences of it never having arrived were. And that information was important enough to encipher, but nobody got that information. So what happened? I'd love to know.
Yeah, well, wouldn't we all? We never got that message. The pigeons just never got through. And, of course, the bloke who wrote it might have not realised that it hadn't got through for some time. He might have sent the message again. And the only place, if it wasn't here in the archives, the only other place it could have gone to is Whitehall.
It was one of a pair, of course, so I wonder what happened to the other one.
Well, I would think that fell by the wayside.
Is that a nice way of saying it was shot down?
Yeah. If it had have got through, somebody would have said, yeah, well, we had that message already. But the thing that's more of a mystery to me is why the actual pigeons, both of them, are not in any of the books. I've got all the birds in World War One and Two, and we haven't got any birds that was ever flown out of Bletchley Park.
So it's not just these two that you don't know about. This might open the way.
Well, that's what we're hoping. Somebody somewhere has got to know what they had up here.
Wouldn't it be a turn-up for the books if it turned out your sister had something to do with pigeons?
It would be.
I hope we find out about this pigeon and what the message says.
I hope we do soon, because it will be very, very interesting.
Thank you. Did Churchill have a secret tunnel to Bletchley Park? And did he order the codebreakers to break up Colossus and destroy the pieces at the end of the war? Myths abound about what happened at Bletchley Park, an inevitable consequence of the ultra level of secrecy. Best-selling author of The Secrets of Station X, Michael Smith, was joined by the GCHQ historian and the eminent codebreaker who went on to become director of GCHQ, Sir Arthur Bonsall, to set the record straight.
Bletchley Park played no role in the Battle of Britain. Is that fact or fiction? OK, Bill?
The Battle of Britain happened in the very early days of Enigma. It was no surprise. It played little part. It had little impact on the outcome. But Air Section staff, working at the RAF Y station at Cheadle in Staffordshire, enabled Cheadle to identify the bomber units, where they were based, and give advance warning that they were preparing to take off on raids. This improved the early warning, so essential to fighter command. Alongside this, coastal Y stations under Kingsdown in Kent intercepted radio telephony from German Air Force escorting fighters, and they were also able to detect which units were preparing to take off and to fill gaps in the then existing radar coverage, which was unable to report flying heights or to distinguish which formations were fighters and which were bombers.
Churchill had a tunnel from the railway station to the centre of the park so he could sneak in without anyone noticing him coming.
Of course, there was no tunnel and there weren't frequent visits. Any visit by Churchill to Bletchley was likely to compromise his existence, draw it unnecessarily to people's attention. He only came once. This was in the autumn of 1941. His purpose was to meet the chief codebreakers in Hut 6. And afterwards, he stood on the heap of rubble outside Hut 6 and made a short speech encouraging them. A number of the junior girls in Hut 6 who hadn't been introduced to Churchill were determined, at least, to wave him goodbye. And his car all this time had been parked outside the mansion ready to go, with an ATS driver sitting in it, ramrod straight, looking straight ahead. And after Churchill had left Hut 6 and went back to the mansion to say goodbye to the director, they formed a little group outside the front door near the car. And Churchill, on coming out of the building, noticed a group of people, and being a politician, he also noticed a suitable stone to stand on. There was then a ring of flat stones, rather like the one that has been replaced there. It was something that he could stand up on and address his group in exhortatory terms. It so happened that I was crossing the grass past the mansion on the way to the canteen in my lunch break, noticed a group of people there, unusual thing in any case, and to my astonishment, there was Churchill in the middle of it. His visit had not been announced to the staff in general, and it was supposed to be a great secret anyhow. The moment he'd finished his speech, he descended from the stone, got into his car, drove off round the corner. Just before he was out of sight, he could be seen taking documents out of his briefcase.
The well-known code breakers constantly behaved eccentrically. Is this true?
Well, there are many stories illustrating the eccentricity of some of the leading code breakers, leaving the impression that they constantly behaved in this way. Thus, the idea that Josh Cooper always used to put his teacup on his head, and that Turing used to ride his bicycle wearing a gas mask. I worked closely with Josh for some 5 years and never saw this sign of eccentricity. Turing may well have cycled wearing a gas mask, perhaps when there was a high pollen count. It would be logical to do that. But I saw him many times on his bicycle and never once wearing a mask.
Did Churchill order Bletchley to destroy all the Colossus computers at the end of the war?
Well, he issued no such order. When the codebreakers left Bletchley Park, two Colossus machines went with them. The parts of the other Colossi were recycled for post office use. Post office were in the middle of replacing or hand exchanges with automatic ones, and these were the sort of bits they used. And many of them were given to Manchester University, where Max Newman had set up the Royal Society Computing Machine Laboratory. It produced the first working stored program electronic computer in 1948. The two Colossi at GCHQ were used on a variety of projects before being broken up and the parts recycled in the 1960s.
The Germans bombed Bletchley Park, blowing Hut 4 off its foundations. Bill is going to talk about it because Bill was here.
The Germans never targeted Bletchley Park. They did not even know that it was an important place which might have become a target. No doubt because MI5 had got all the German spies in the UK under their MI5's control. What seems to have happened on the night of the 20th, 21st November is that a bomber, having a few small bombs left over from a raid on some target in the Midlands, decided to unload them when he happened to be flying in this area. When I returned to Hut 4, my place of work, the following morning, I learnt that a bomb had fallen a few yards from the right-hand end of the hut. During my lunch hour, I went outside to have a look, and there, a few yards from the end of Hut 4, I saw a shallow crater beside a small hut, an unnumbered one. I never really knew what it was used for, but understood it was an overflow from the typing pool in the mansion. Not right up against the hut, but quite near it, and the small hut was leaning over slightly in the direction of the mansion, and it was generally thought, I understood, that a couple of men would probably be able to push it back upright. The mythic version of this story says that some wrens on night duty in the other end of Hut 4 felt the earth move. They may have done so.
Events coming up at Bletchley Park include the Remembrance Service, which departs from the park at 10:30 on the morning of Sunday, the 11th of November. It's been such a success in recent years, there's now no parking on site. And on the 8th and 9th of December, Santa has promised to make a special effort to make it to the Festival of Christmas. Students from Milton Keynes College will showcase their talents, from cooking to beauty therapy, in the Mansion Takeover. And so to the Enigma Challenge. School children in Manchester had a chance to pit their wits against the bomb team. The bomb operators worked furiously each morning over 3 days to deduce the settings on an Enigma machine at the Museum of Science and Industry, which was operated by the historians of GCHQ. Their best time was 2.25 hours, beating hands down the average time it took the wartime codebreakers, according to veteran Wrens, who recall it took around 4 hours most nights, starting when the Enigma settings were changed at midnight. I spoke to John Harper and Paul Keller from the bomb team. So, how's it gone?
Superbly well, just like the last one. We've been breaking the codes in short order and sending the messages back correctly all afternoon. The Manchester people have been ever so busy that GCHQ are pleased with us, which is a good thing to happen. We're, if you like, smug but not at all complacent.
You couldn't be sure that it would go well, of course. You don't want people to think that it was easy.
No, I'm glad you said that, because something went wrong in the middle of today, the last day, due to a very common error in message transmission, which would have happened in the war. It threw us for a bit. What the team has now done is reinvent the process that they would have used here in the war if that had happened, and they won't catch us again.
So it's just something that the codebreakers and the Wrens could have come across on any given night, really.
Including the other Enigma operator who was at the receiving end of this message. He could equally have seen the same problem, but because he's most likely conversant with the sort of problems that would have happened regularly, he'd immediately corrected it and got an answer.
How did you feel when you got your first break in on Saturday?
Whoopee! Really pleased, because it isn't as easy as it looks. But the thing that's so pleasing is not that we've broken the code, but we've done it just like they did. If any of the, you know, the Enigma or codebreakers turned up again, they could join right in the team and carry on where they left off. There's no point in just breaking it. You have to break it in the right way.
Authenticity is important, isn't it?
That's
the
right.
The process.
And in this particular case, in both Saturday and Sunday, the code was broken quicker than it was on previous occasions.
During the war, they must have sort of streamlined the processes. But of course, to start again at midnight every day, it is like wiping the slate clean, isn't it? You never quite know what you're going to be faced with.
That's correct. They had a special department called the Duddery, whose job it was to cope with things that didn't work the first time. We've sort of built one of those today.
Is it difficult to communicate to people just how complicated a process it was and is, and how many stages there are to it, and how crucial each bit of it is?
Well, I think the majority find that difficult, but we have got people here. They're explaining it in simple terms to a lot of the visitors.
And the children up in Manchester, have they sort of coped with the complexity of it well?
Oh, yeah, they love it. But at the same time, GCHQ are presenting it to them in a form that makes it interesting and palatable.
Code-breaking can be fun.
That's the whole motive behind it, was the GCHQ, to try and inspire the youngsters and ultimately recruit more people.
And looking at the reactions of visitors here today and what you've seen on the video link from Mosey over the weekend, do you think you've achieved that this time?
Well, you've certainly got a lot of interested children and youngsters.
We don't like having these barriers around here, but you have to. But what we've done is man them with people who know what they're talking about. So in some ways, the visitors get a better presentation than they normally do.
Secrecy was paramount at Bletchley Park, and everyone who worked here signed the Official Secrets Act. But one woman signed it in particularly unusual circumstances. Now, she met Mark Cotton, who produces this podcast and is with me now. Mark, tell me about Wynne Ribchester.
Yes, Wynne moved here in 1938, before the codebreakers actually turned up at Bletchley Park.
Very few staff lived on site, didn't they? So Wynne's father must have had an unusual job, perhaps involved in running of the operation.
Yes, her father was a civilian member of staff and, as far as we know, was working in the setting up of Bletchley Park in readiness for the codebreakers to arrive.
She generally must have had a very strange experience being that age, living in such a unique place.
Oh, talking to Wynne was absolutely fascinating, because one of the nicest things about doing the podcast is that we get to meet so many veterans, and all of them have got amazing stories to tell. And each of them has a different take on their time at Bletchley Park. But I think, personally, Wynne's is possibly one of the most unique that you're ever going to hear.
In January 1938, My father came down here to work, and he said that we would move down here to live after the end of the summer term of school. So he worked here, and he used to commute back to Twickenham, where we lived. And we came and we moved into number 2 cottage, as it is now, in 1938. And we stayed here until 1942.
Was this prior to the codebreakers moving in, or had some of them
already? Oh, yes, rather. I mean, he showed us around the house, and I didn't like it. It was spooky. It was empty, not a stick of furniture anywhere, but lots and lots of electric cable where they're obviously rewiring. And on the floor of every room, there were telephones about to be installed. In those days, telephone handsets were always black. But as we went around, I noticed some were green, and in some of the principal rooms, some of them were actually red. And there was just nothing in the place whatsoever. And I didn't go into the mansion again until after the war had started, when I had to go in and be interviewed.
Is this true that you signed the Official Secrets Act?
Oh, yes, completely true.
What age were you when that happened?
13.
Were you given a stiff talking to, or was it just a noisy?
No, it was rather funny, really, because my father really hammered it into us. You must not talk about anything. He met me at the gate, and he said, oh, some people want to talk to you. So we went into the mansion. I couldn't believe it. It was absolutely buzzing. Telephones, teleprinters, typewriters. And it was interesting because on all the doors, there were little plaques with numbers and letters on. No names. We went up to the first floor, and he pushed me into this room and said, there's some people want to talk to you, I'll wait out here. No explanation. And I went in, and I was confronted by a long table covered in a grey army blanket. Seated at the table, there were 3 very high-ranking officers, one from each of the services. In front of each man was a brand-new, unused notepad and a pencil and his service cap. It amused me faintly because every peak of the service caps were pointing in the same direction, all very military. And the man in the middle was army. I think he was a colonel. And he set off by saying, you know, name and all that stuff. And then he said, when you're at school, do the other children ask you what's going on here? Oh, I said, yes, all the time. And they all leaned forward rather anxiously and said, and what do you say? So I said, well, it's just a lot of civil servants from London. Of course, that's what my father said, you know, you mustn't say anything else. So that seemed to satisfy them. And then he said, are you ever approached by grown-ups or on the train or in the town? I said, no. And then he made a great long speech about how important Bletchley Park was and that it was absolutely vital that nothing should be discussed or given away at all. And he really hammered this point home. And then he fished into his briefcase and put out a document in front of me and said rather solemnly, this is the Official Secrets Act. I could see that because it was on the top. And he said, it's a solemn pledge, a solemn promise, because this place has got to be kept very secret. And he went on and on. And then he handed me a very, very posh fountain pen. And he said, you must write your name in capitals there and then sign it and date it. So I did that, and he said, thank you for coming. And I went to join my father. And as I went out, I heard someone chuckle. And I was a prickly little devil, actually. And I said, they're laughing at me. He said, no, they aren't. He said, they're laughing because you're the youngest ever to sign the OSA, because I was 13. You know, they needn't have bothered. It was obviously very, very heavily stage-managed to impress a schoolgirl. But as I said, I'd had it dinned into me, my father, so they were, you know, it was really a bit of a rain dance.
I believe there's a story about you and the daily passwords.
Oh, God, that was awful. Well, what happened was they had this, well, now I think of it, it was a daft system. When the big steel fence went up with the barbed wire on the top, which incidentally incorporated a much, much bigger area than the original little crude wooden fence. And they had these passwords. Well, they were changed at 8:30. And I caught my train at 8:30 to school. It was one station up the line. And so when I came in the afternoon, I never knew it. And the people on the gate used to say, oh, hello, Wynne, how are you? Good day at school, you know, chatty like that. And then they would march me up to the mansion for formal identification. And I said, look, this is ridiculous. You know who I am. And I would go up to the mansion and my name would be written in a book at the time of arrival, and that was it. And I really got fed up with this. And I said, why do you do this? You know that I live here. You know who I am. It is procedure. But it didn't last long. We had passes after that. It was much easier.
Jean Cheshire, who's one of our volunteers, also lived here during the war. Can you tell me how you first met her?
Well, Jean's father and my father were close friends. And I remember him coming round our house looking decidedly shaken, because there were no scans in those days. And he said, I've got two daughters. And I finally met Jean when she was about 10 days old. And I reminded her of it recently, and she said, 10 days old? So I don't remember that.
What did you think of the people who were working here?
Oh, well, it depended who they were. We had billetees, and we had two sorts. We had two who were with us for about a year and a half, one after the other, not together. And they were terribly indiscreet, and they would talk about anything. I think they felt that since they were on station, it didn't matter. One of them was a squadron leader in the RAF, and I kept hearing him and his chums talking about something. And I said to him, what is this? Oh, he said, that's called RDF. So I said, well, what's that? And he said, it stands for radio direction finding. So I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, you fire a radio beam up into the sky, and if there are aeroplanes up there, the beam is reflected back to England. And he said, and there are RDF listening stations all round the coast. I mean, terrible saying all this. I said, well, what good does that do? So he said, well, they can tell from the echoes how many aeroplanes, their height, their direction, and their range, and how many there are. So I said, that's marvellous. He said, yes, and it's all very secret, so you keep your mouth shut, which, of course, I did. And, of course, that was later known as radar. And then we had a whole lot of billeties who were, I used to privately call them my flybynights. And they would come from don't know where, and they would stay 3 days, a week. And I noticed that they never went out of the park, and they spent all their time in the mansion. And they didn't work shifts, they did sort of office hours, and then they were gone. And they were very nice and very friendly, and they used to tell me all about the theatres and the art galleries and museums that I would see after the war. And they never talked down to me. They never patronised me or anything. And I liked them all very much, actually. And that 4 years, believe you me, I had to grow up.
What was it like, I mean, just generally being a child? I mean, could you play in the grounds at all?
No, and I couldn't have any visitors. I never had a birthday party or a birthday tea, and I never had friends in to play with me. They just were not allowed. And one Saturday, a couple of my chums came up to the park and said, oh, can we go in and see Wynne, you see? And they were told in no uncertain terms to push off. So all my friendships were very one-sided. I could see them, but they couldn't see me. So it was lonely, really. But you just put up with things as a child, don't you? You adapt.
Did you ever get a chance to talk to your parents about what was actually happening here after the war, sort of years later?
No, my father never said a word. And when we went back to Twickenham to live, and I said, well, where are you working? And he said, I'm working in London. End of conversation. And that was that.
Thank you so much, Wynne.
You're very welcome.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.